Welcome to Food Freedom Radio. I'm Laura Hedlund, a student of nature-led gardening and a person exhausted, absolutely exhausted by being triggered. So a news story from this week. PFAS is in our blood, and researchers have documented that PFAS, or forever chemicals, are associated with heart disease. And also in our blood is microplastics. 80% of the people tested in one study had microplastics in their blood. So there are so many reasons to be triggered. Human-caused famine, human-caused climate change, and endless dramas and divisions blaring on our screens. But my being triggered adds to the emotional disruptions. I want to calm my nerves, stand in my power, and shout from the rooftop, what we do to the other, we do to ourselves. What we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And the other day I saw a common slogan on a t-shirt. It said, good vibes only. And for a split second, I wondered, does this phrase mean faking happiness or ignoring negative news? Then I recalled times where sad places were full of good vibes. Funerals, hard conversations, support meetings, authentic human interactions. The hardest times in my life, the death of my mother, the death of my father, my brother, were tough, but they were full of good vibes. So how do I have good vibes when I learned that more than 50 billion tons of topsoil have eroded in the Midwest? Studies show 80% of Minnesota River headwaters fail to meet water quality standards. And it is literally raining glyphosate on us. But instead of yelling at what's wrong, instead of being triggered, I want to celebrate right action and look for the glimmers. Looking for the glimmers can be as simple as noticing blue in the sky, touching feet to the ground, breathing, holding a baby, being with a dog, smiling at a stranger, and start seeing glimmers, and it's so good for our mental health and our well-being. Glimmers are a balm for our frayed nerves. And as we put a spotlight on glimmers, we help them birth and we grow new glimmers. So on today's show, we're going to talk about two glimmers in the food system, moving to agroforestry. Agroforestry combines agriculture and forestry. It means more diverse, profitable, and healthy farms. And benefits include increasing farm income, reducing soil erosion, creating wildlife habitat, and increasing biodiversity, improving soil structure, water quality, and carbon sequestration. So next week in the Northfield area, there's going to be two important events going on in the agroforestry area. So March 21st and 22nd is the third annual Regenerative Poultry Conference, Convergence, the Regenerative Poultry Conversion. So that's tree range chickens, so trees, chickens and hazelnuts combined. And then also on March 22nd and 23rd, there's their 15th annual Upper Midwest Hazelnut Growers Conference. So later in the program, we're going to be talking with the hazelnut researcher Lois Brahm about this conference and the potential of hazelnuts to create that glimmer in our food system. But the second glimmer is you and I. And you and I discovering the power of gardening to heal ourselves and to heal the earth. So joining us now is the owner of Green Earth Growers, Jenny Hott. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to Food Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Great. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I've been doing Green Earth Growers for about 20 years. We are a wholesale greenhouse company and a vegetable and cut flower farm.
Cool. And then, so how did you even start on that? What's your journey been like?
Well, we started about 20 years ago. And I actually was working for another farm in the area called Green Fingers Farms. My current business partner and one of my best friends from college, she originally had a job on that farm. They were looking to hire other people. I was looking for a job, so I ended up kind of in agriculture that way. I had been going to the University of Minnesota for a bachelor of science, like a natural resource environmental studies degree. But through working at Green Fingers Farms and a couple other jobs that I had done, and I just decided agriculture was what it was, what I wanted to do. Unfortunately, the stint with Green Fingers Farms did not last very long. They were going through transition. The business was sold to somebody, and that other owner really only ran it for about a year, and we were all lost without a job, basically, very abruptly. And so I had previously, when I was finishing up my studies at the University of Minnesota, I had been doing a study abroad program over in Kenya, studying dryland agricultural systems over there. So when the thing with Greenfingers Farms kind of fizzled out, I was like, well, I'll go back over to Kenya. I had an NGO that I was working for over there. I really loved living over there. So I skipped country and I went back across the ocean. In the meantime, one of the original owners of Greenfingers Farms contacted my business partner and friend from college and said, hey, we've got greenhouse space available. You guys want to lease it and do something, you know, and get something going? And our naive mid 20 year old, you know, minds were like, yeah, let's do it. And so this was back in the day. It was like I had to go to internet cafes when I was over in Kenya and check my email a couple times a week. And I had a bunch of emails from Jolie, basically my business partner, saying, you should come back. We got this really cool thing. We could do it. Like, but you should come back. And so so I did. So I came back to the country. We pulled together whatever we could for the very first season, cleaned out a bunch of dirty, grimy greenhouses, got, you know, a client list from the previous owner, and we just kind of jumped into it blindly. And that was in 2004, and we're still here.
We're still here. What a beautiful slogan. We're still here. And so, and I want to do a shout out. Like I learned about you on Seward Co-op because they did a news release on women owned businesses. And so is it common to have women owned businesses in this area?
No, especially not 20 years ago. In the area that we are, which is Prior Lakes, so we're a little bit down south of the cities. So there's a lot of generational family farms out in this area. And when we started doing what we were doing, we were the only women in the game out here. It was a lot of like family run and a lot of men that had been doing it, you know, a couple of them been doing farming in their family for generations. And so I think they thought we were kind of cute at first. They were just kind of like, oh, look at them. They're gardening. They're trying to farm, you know? And then when we just kept sticking it out and, I guess they saw the amount of work we were putting in, maybe we won them over somehow and became part of the farming community out here. And it's been lovely. It's been great.
I absolutely love it. So tell us about your business model. What do you sell and how do you sell it?
Sure. So we kind of have three different facets of what we sell at the farm. So springtime right now, we are in the full swing of greenhouse season. So we sell a lot of, or we wholesale a lot of annuals, bedding plants, heirloom vegetables, herbs, hanging baskets, patio pots, whatever you would find at like your typical kind of flower store. So we wholesale to a few, a handful of different kind of earth-friendly specialty greenhouses up in the city. So if you're looking for our plants, you can find them metro-wide. So that's what we kind of do winter through spring. Once the weather changes, we farm throughout the summer, and we kind of have two facets in that department. So we have a vegetable farm and we have a cut flower farm. And we do a CSA in both of those farms. We do a CSA for veggies and a CSA for flowers. And then the flower farm also wholesales flowers to some of the local co-ops as well, which is, I think, our connection with Seward plants and cut flowers.
And so 20 years of business, has this been an easy thing to do to create? Would you say your business is now thriving and functioning?
I mean, yes. We have, throughout the years, carved out our committed, you know, customers. It has definitely changed throughout the years. Let's just say that. We're not who we were 20 years ago. We've grown a lot. I think a lot of people that have tried our products, our plants and whatnot, have joined up with us and just kind of come along for the ride. I mean, we started out years ago basically doing transplants for farmers. So we would do plug trays for farmers. They would come pick it up for us, and then they would go out and plant it out in the field. So we did that, and we did farmers markets. And that was kind of our jump, our first kind of, you know, paychecks that we were turning out of the greenhouse. Throughout the years now, we've actually transitioned a little bit away from that and grown more in the wholesale direction where we, are selling potted up plants for resale.
So we're going to talk more about, you know, how we can even give some tips on how people can start gardening and the benefits of gardening and different ways to garden. But now, do you ever use any Roundup in your products?
Absolutely not.
Okay, why not?
Health and environmental risks associated with that product and glyphosate in general. So no, that was, and that was another thing that actually like spiked my interest into going into agriculture. Learning about how broken our food system is when we've moved from small farms to factory farms and widespread production and the quote unquote green revolution, which was just a lot of herbicides and pesticide applications. I didn't like it, and I wanted to grow my own food, and I wanted to know where my food was coming from, and I wanted to grow food responsibly and sustainably and without all of those things. And so I figured if I was feeling that way, other people probably were too. And other people are. Nobody wants to have a side of chemicals with their veggies when they're eating.
Well, and I heard Dr. Zach Bush speak on this for like 2 hours. I listened to one of his podcasts. And it is really sad about how human hubris and working with nature. And that's why I'm now saying I'm not just, you know, a permaculture. I'm more with nature-led gardening, because humility to the natural world is just a common sense thing. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. You can't escape it. So you may as well go with the flow with it.
And it's not, and going with the flow with nature is actually far more, it's a glimmer, not a trigger, right?
Yes, exactly.
And yet, now I think about it, and this is, I mean, there are a lot of triggers, like you don't get enough rain when, it is hard to see some weeds taking up all the resources. And you know, there can be a lot of challenges, obviously, with growing food, but trying to have a system that that sees that life and really flourish with nature instead of working against nature.
Absolutely.
Cool. And so then, so what you do instead, well, we're going to need to take a break, but instead you fertilize with microorganisms and you do something called integrated pest management. So we're going to talk about that in the next segment. We're also going to talk about how do the unusually warm winter affect our growing season, and then give tips on how we can all grow food. So you're listening to Food Freedom Radio. I'm Laura Hedlund, and we're talking right now with the owner of Green Earth Growers. You can find out more about them by greenearthgrowers.net. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Food Freedom Radio. I'm Laura Hedlund, a student of nature-led gardening. And joining us right now is the co-owner of Green Earth Growers, Jenny Hotz. And in the last segment, we were talking, you have three different business models going. And in the last segment, we talked about you do not use any Roundup. So what do you do instead of chemicals and fertilizers? How do you help grow? How do you farm without those poisons?
Sure. So we're really big on, you know, compost in the fall. Prior to tilling everything in, before wintertime, to kind of keep those microorganisms in check and add fertility that may have been taken out. Crop rotation is a huge thing. The compost that we add is a different combination. We actually have a landscape company that, is happy to give us as much, grass material and leaves that they're like clearing up during like their fall cleaning. So they come out and dump truckloads of like nitrogen rich leaf material. We also have a local dairy farmer that is happy to share manure with us as well.
Ooh.
So so we get all the good things put on the soil in the fall and then till it all in. And I mean, a happy plant just grows better when it's, you know, we've had really dry weather the past couple of years, but we are able to irrigate, so that's good. But I mean, just having the right nutrients, micronutrients there, it helps the plants get a healthy start, which gives them a jump above weeds. So that's like the first line of defense, I guess, against weedy or, you know, more invasive plants. I do mechanically remove weeds that are like in the walkway so that we can still harvest safely and, you know, get to the plants. And then we do also manually like remove weeds in between the rows of the plants and stuff like that. There's a few areas that we kind of do more of like the permaculture model, where it's like they are planted in rows of clover and you mow the clover. So that's a different method that we use sometimes depending on what the crop is. That's more for like our woody herbaceous cut flower species, so like shrubs that are permanently there, or our apple orchard. So we kind of use those methods for fertility and weed prevention there. And then I also have a fair amount of like landscape fabric also that I use for kind of more perennial plants, the raspberries, rhubarb, honeyberry, so things like that. Tomatoes that I actually trellis, I will do landscape fabric around that. So a lot of different ways to manage the weeds and make sure that the plants have the best possible start that they can have.
So let's talk of some, give some tips for maybe people who might be beginning and considering starting gardening. What would the first thing be that you would suggest, or what kind of tips do you have to offer?
Yeah, so your site preparation in your yard is going to be the least glamorous thing, but one of the most important steps, I would have to say. A good foundation is just really, really important. So you have to select a site that has, I would say, at least 10 hours of sunlight, you know, a day if you're trying to grow vegetables and flower varieties. If you're doing perennials or landscaping stuff, there's plenty of shade stuff, but your veggies really need a lot of sunlight exposure. Raised beds work really well. You can put a nice layer at the base of your raised bed to just alleviate any weed problems popping up. And then just do a little research on your soil, figure out what you have in your ground to start with, and then figure out if there's anything you need to add or amend or anything like that. And that's probably going to give you the most successful start to your garden.
And then let's talk about some specific plants, because one thing I like is plants that are both flowers and food. Ferns, of course, are also decorative, and you get the little things. But so name some that you think are good in that are both pretty and edible.
So I've been getting more into like plant herbalism lately, and my favorite flower it's not edible, but calendula. Mm. It's a very good, very soothing herb for like skin care.
Is that a tea that's really good for women to like ease period pain?
It is too. So like topical has a little bit different of effect than, you know, internally ingesting it or taking it. My daughter has eczema that she gets seasonally, and I've been using a combination of like coconut oil and rope infused with rosemary, and that seems to do really well for her. So yeah, I mean, plants are really cool. There's a lot more that you can do with them besides just eat them.
yeah. The other thing I want to talk is like the patio urban gardens. So some people have really small spaces, but what can you do in a small space?
Oh, you can put just about anything you want to in a pot. I mean, the size of the pot does matter. So, I mean, a bigger plant like a tomato, you might need to mitigate that by getting like rather than a indeterminate variety. Indeterminate just means it's going to grow forever. Determinate means it's going to grow to a certain height. There's so many like really great determinate varieties out there that would fit into, you know, a regular size patio pot that, as long as, you know, they have enough sunlight. Tomatoes are a little bit tricky. They need a lot of water. So if you stay on top of your watering with your tomatoes, I mean, you could pretty much, I think, we sell tomatoes in patio pots. We sell peppers, peas, lettuces, cucumbers. So it's really just up to you and making sure, again, good soil, good water, and good light. And I think anyone can put a vegetable plant on their back stoop and watch it grow. And herbs are a really easy one to do to start out with in pots. And herbs are kind of great because you can cut again off them. So a lot of them, you can harvest as many times as you want to during the season. So I always kind of suggest that's a really good one for people to start out with, herbs, like an herb garden.
Like a little herb garden, especially with small spots. And like I have a rosemary plant that's 4 feet, 5 feet now. So, I mean, it's huge. And so it's a really great source. One of the things I also like is making your own little tea gardens or herb beverages. And citronellas are really good. I think there's so many people that are feeling this anxiety right now. So having growing things in your yard which can calm your nerves, and having a little teas that you make, and like catnip is a really good tea for that too.
Yeah. Lavender is good for calming, chamomile as well. Kind of all of those. And one of the things that is also, I mean, like, yeah, it's something therapeutic about watching something grow from seed to fruition and then being able to use then, you know, what you grow. I think that's kind of lost maybe in modern society. I mean, there's just not that connection to the earth anymore, or your patio pot if you're growing on a, you know, in a container garden. Well, but there is just something waiting for it, and, you know, like, just watching it grow.
And I heard, I think it was Dr. Zach Bush that said this, but, you know, that the earth is actually waiting for us. And we, you know, it's waiting for us and how we catch up. And Maria Rodel, and of course her family was with the Rodel Institute, and like they published the Prevention magazine a long time ago. But she has a new book out, and I'll be talking with her at the end of the month, which has the word magic in it. And the gardening is magical. I mean, you see a small seed and it grows into this big oak tree and acorn. I mean, it's just, our world is full of such awe and wonder. And gardening and getting into that soil, and even if it's looking at one small little plant, it's about entering the magic that is life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep.
So, Jenny, we're down to our last few minutes. Anything else you'd like to say?
I was just going to say that if I know we've had a lot of people that have been talking about, you know, the warm spring and the warm weather and everything that we've been having. I guess my bit of farmer wisdom would be, it doesn't matter how warm it is in the daytime, you got to watch those nighttime temperatures, because all it takes is one night before freezing and everything that you've done is gone.
Well, and that's, yeah, with the unusual warm with the unusual warm weather, how do you think that is going to impact our growing? But I think you're right, you got to be cautious, because even I'm like, oh, can I put on my plants? Yeah. Don't.
All of like the Facebook garden forums and stuff that following, everyone's like, I'm going to plant peas. You know, should I do it? Should I do it? And I'm just like, no, don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Everything's early so far. I mean, basically, I've got some neighbors that do like maple syrup harvest, and their maple syrup harvest was 3 weeks earlier than it's been. It wasn't the earliest it's ever been, but it's early. I was just out kind of scoping up some of my perennial plants, and I've got garlic, little teeny tiny garlic heads that are starting to pop up, and that usually happens around the first week of April. So, and kind of what I've been seeing is things are about 3 weeks early at this point. Will we get a cold snap that sets it back? Maybe. It's Minnesota, who knows? But that's just why I just am kind of telling people this year, just be cautious. Really watch your night temperatures before you decide to dive in and put that first thing in the ground.
Right. Curb your enthusiasm. So Jenny Holtz, I appreciate you coming in. And again, the website is greenearthgrowers.net. So thank you so much. And when we come back, we're going to talk about hazelnuts and the upcoming Hazelnut Conference. So you're listening to Food Freedom Radio on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Welcome back to Food Freedom Radio. I'm Laura Hedlund, a student of nature-led gardening and someone excited about agroforestry. Agroforestry can mean more diverse and productive and profitable and healthy and sustainable farms. Benefits include increasing farm income, reducing soil erosion, creating wildlife habitat, increasing biodiversity, helping with water quality, improving soil and carbon sequestration. So next weekend, there's going to be two conferences going on in the Northfield area, both kind of focusing on agroforestry. One is the third annual Regenerative Poultry Conference, and also on March 22nd and 23rd is the 15th annual Upper Midwest Hazelnuts Growers Conference. And joining right now is a hazelnut researcher, Lois Brown. Hi, welcome to Food Freedom Radio.
Hi.
So, Lois, tell us a little bit about yourself, your personal background.
Well, I kind of stumbled into hazelnuts. When I graduated from college, one of the first things I did was I became an intern at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, where this was 1985, where they had developed what they called natural systems agriculture, which is agriculture modeled after natural ecosystems. And they said, if you want to know what's sustainable in your area, study what the natural ecosystem supports, which in Kansas was the prairie. So they identified two key features of the prairie. One is perenniality. Most of the plants in prairies are perennials. And the other is plants grow in mixtures, and there are synergistic effects between different components of that ecosystem. So the Land Institute was working to develop domesticated prairies, and they had identified some native prairie plants that had they perceived as having potential as food plants, and embarked on a process of domesticating them, and that usually meant increasing seed size and harvestability characteristics, less shattering and things like that. And one of the crops that actually didn't begin at the Land Institute but went through the Land Institute is kernza, which some of you may have heard of, which is related to wheat, but it isn't quite wheat, but it's a perennial grain. And it's
so perennial grains, what are the advantages of perennial grains?
Right. So they have enough time in the ground to develop a deep root system, which prevents against, holds the soil, prevents against soil erosion, keeps nutrients from leaching deep into the soil. They build soil organic matter. And obviously, they don't have to be planted every year, so you don't have to plow the ground. And plowing, it both requires a lot of energy for tractors, but also when you disturb the soil, you're oxidizing the soil organic matter, releasing the carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, which contributes to climate change. So that's one of the big advantages of perennial grains.
I know this week I went to a great event at Red Wagon Pizza, and they were using kernza, but only 10-15% because it's more of a nutty flavor, but they were using it in their pizza crust. And it was a wonderful taste test. And it could just, having more kernza on perennial grains would make such a difference to our ecosystem. It'd be a big glimmer.
Right. Yeah. And so, actually I've been eating kernza in my breakfast cereal, and it's wonderful. Yeah. So the other feature is plants in mixtures, so that, you know, you have nitrogen fixing plants adjacent to non-nitrogen fixing plants and have some transfer of nutrients between them. I don't think that has agronomically, there's still some challenges to be worked out on that, but that's the vision. And less disease pressure when you don't have monocultures, because diseases don't transfer as easily between different types of species. So those are the ideas. Anyway, so fast forward years later, let me see, like 15 years later, I moved to Minnesota. And I don't need to tell you all the places and things I did in the interim. They're all very interesting, but not necessarily relevant. And I found myself actually looking for a job at the U of M, because I had to live in the U of M because that's where my partner lived, but I wanted an agricultural job. So the only place to get a job was the U of M, and somebody knew somebody and offered me this position working with hazelnuts, which immediately it was like bingo. In Kansas it's a prairie, in Minnesota it's the oak savanna, and hazelnuts are a component of the oak savanna, and all those things that I just suggested to you about perennial grains apply to hazelnuts. So, you know, holding the soil in place, preventing leaching, building soil organic matter. You don't have to plow all the time. Much more efficient use of nutrients and ecological diversity. And I would say it's even more obvious with hazelnuts, because they're a shrub and they can be used as windbreaks and they can be used on contour plantings. And as windbreaks, they are actually great wildlife habitat, especially for birds. And we see a lot of bird nests in them. And we see some wildlife we're not so excited about, like deer. One time I was mowing and I rousted up a fawn, and I carefully tried to shepherd it away so I wouldn't hurt it. But tree frogs, bats. We've got pictures of all sorts of things in the hazelnuts.
I've had hazelnuts in my yard for a long time. And so, I mean, can you imagine what our cities would be like if instead of planting rows of buckthorn, whatever it was 50 years ago, we decided we were planting hazelnuts instead?
Mm-hmm. So I commonly get the question about, I'd like to plant one or two hazelnuts in my yard. And people ask for recommendations about that. And I have to tell them a couple of problems with the landscape. It's perfectly fine if you want them for ornamentals. If you want them as a hedge, that's good as well. But there are some challenges on an urban scale. One is that hazelnuts are self-incompatible. Like apple trees, they will not pollinate each other. So if you want to get nuts on them, you have to have at least two, or else consult with your neighbors and persuade them.
You know, consulting with the neighbors and changing so that we're community gardening and really makes a lot of sense.
The other challenge is that hazelnuts are probably the favorite food of squirrels. Almost every kind of wildlife you can imagine, which is great if you want to feed the wildlife. But if you want to feed yourself, it's going to be a little bit more challenge if you have just one or two bushes. If you have a hedgerow, maybe there's enough to share. The advantage of the farm scale is at a certain point, the wildlife tend to go for what's easiest. So they'll predate the perimeter, but they won't get the center.
Right. And I do get hazelnuts. And yes, I have to, you know, compete with the squirrels. And I tend to pick them when they're a little less ripe. And that's one way that I kind of get ahead of the squirrels. But again, you know, more squirrels also mean more hawks. And then the hawks have the squirrels instead of other things. So, I mean, a fresh hazelnut is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good food. So let's talk about hazelnuts on a commercial level and this conference that's coming up. So what's the potential of hazelnuts on a commercial level in Minnesota?
Okay, well, our vision is large. our current reality is not. But we're getting there, we hope. The story is, actually, I need to tell you a little bit more about the breeding of hazelnuts.
Sure.
So we have Native American hazelnuts, a species called American hazelnuts here in the Midwest. In fact, you might notice there's the American Hazelnut Company, and one is a Midwest grower-owned company. You might wonder, why is it called American when it's actually Midwest? And the reason for that is because it's the American hazelnut species, and we are the center of diversity of the American hazelnuts. They're actually widely distributed in North America, but they're most common in the upper Midwest. They're actually very common in the woods of central Minnesota and north. Sherman National Wildlife Refuge is full of them. In southern Minnesota, the more agricultural areas, they've been wiped out by agriculture, but they used to be more common there. The Native American hazelnuts are obviously adapted to our climate, and we'll see what happens with climate change, but so far they seem to be okay. But more important than that, or just as important, is they co-evolved with the disease. It's called Eastern Filbert Blight. Filbert is an old name for hazelnuts. And it's called Eastern because it exists east of the Rockies. It didn't used to exist west of the Rockies because the Rockies were a barrier to the disease. The Native American hazelnuts co-evolved with the disease. They get it, but they're tolerant to it. The European domesticated hazelnuts are not tolerant to it, and it kills them. And so the commercial hazelnut industry in the United States is almost entirely west of the Rockies, where they've been isolated by the mountains because they can grow in spite of the blight. They're growing European hazelnuts, which have larger nuts, thinner shelled, easier to crack on a commercial level. But the problem with the American hazelnuts is that they're smaller. I mean, some of them are the size of a chickpea. thicker shelled, which makes them really hard to crack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing about home scale production is if you like sitting around your fireplace in the winter and cracking nuts while telling stories, that's great. But nowadays, it seems that few people actually do that. And getting enough for a meal could be a big job.
Yeah. So now I got my hazelnuts from Badger Set in Minnesota. And so I can crack them. They're not that hard to crack. Some are, though. I mean, it's like, I don't know, I'd say 75-85% of them are easy to crack and big enough. They're more of the bigger than chickpea, but smaller than but maybe dime size.
Right.
But do you want to talk about, because they were one of the people that have been really
selling is hybrids between the European and the American. And they're also selling seedlings, which means that they're genetically diverse. They're the result of the array of genes of one parent crossed with the array of genes of another parent. And every individual combines in a completely different way. Just like members of children in a human family are all unique individuals. And so as a commercial crop, that makes it very difficult to harvest. One thing is that they all mature at a different time. On a home scale, it's not a problem. You just, you're hand picking, you go out and harvest this one when it's ready and wait for that one when it's ready. If you're going through with the machine, you need them all to be ready at the same time.
So we're going to need to take a break. We're coming back and we're going to talk more. When we come back, we're going to talk about the 15th annual Hazelnut Conference. How do we get hazelnuts up to a commercial level? Some of the challenges and also some of the promises. Hazelnuts are great for the environment. They provide cover. They also have a very deep rooted system, so they sequence their carbon. And we're talking with a hazelnut researcher, Lois Brown. We'll be right back. You're listening to Food Freedom Radio on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Welcome back to Food Freedom Radio. I'm Laura Hedlund, and we're talking with a hazelnut researcher, Lois Brown. Welcome back to Food Freedom Radio, Lois. And last segment, we were talking about some of the challenges of commercial production of hazelnuts here in Minnesota. But what are some of the potentials?
Okay, so when we left off, I was talking about Badger Set's hybrid hazelnuts and about the fact that they're seedlings, so they're genetically diverse. So to make them a commercially viable crop, we need a little bit more uniformity. Diversity is good for ecological reasons, but uniformity is necessary for farming. And this is where we've hit the bottleneck. What we did was we identified the best individuals in amongst all the diversity out there. And now we're trying to propagate them clonally, which with apples, they do that with grafting. With many houseplants, they do that with stem cuttings. Those methods, well, grafting doesn't really work with hazelnuts. Stem cutting actually it might work, but we use a method called layering, which is much more labor intensive. And so far, what has really slowed us down is getting the propagation. But we think we've been finally cracking that nut. And
no
so,
pun intended.
Our vision is large scale plantings in Minnesota. Deployed first in critically ecologically sensitive areas. So, for example, wellhead catchment areas, areas prone to erosion. Southeast Minnesota, the Driftless region, is has a lot of farms that really shouldn't be farmed.
And they shouldn't be farmed because that goes straight into the aquifer's water.
Exactly. And so they're not adapted to, they don't like wet feet. So we wouldn't have them in wetlands, maybe adjacent to wetlands, though.
But the potential is so enormous for commercial products because you can make, obviously hazelnuts are great just eating them raw, eating them fresh. You can roast them, you can make flour, you make oil. Talk about some of the commercial potentialities.
Well, the American Hazelnut Company is selling them roasted. They have several spicy versions, one with rosemary, one with, I think, chili, and just plain salted are great. That's the way I like to eat them. They also grind them. They extract the oil, and the press cake that's left over after oil extraction can be ground into flour, which can be used in baking.
And, of course, that's a gluten-free flour as a hazelnut flour.
Correct. But it also means that it's not going to be used for bread that needs gluten for rising, but it could be used in baking powder breads, probably mixed with other kinds of flours. I'm not a food chemist, so I don't understand all that. Two uses that I want to see developed. You could do these on the home scale, but I don't personally have time to do that. Is just ground it into something like peanut butter.
Oh.
I myself am a peanut butter fiend. I would love to take hazelnut butter sandwiches to work. The other one is to use it as a hazelnut milk. I eat cereal for breakfast every morning. If I had hazelnut milk on my breakfast, that would be great.
How cool.
And I think there is potential for that coming up.
Wonderful. So we're talking with Lois Brown, hazelnut researcher. We have just 2 minutes left, and so there's this conference coming up. Tell us about it.
So it's in Northfield. It's our 15th annual. This year, although there will be a few sessions on the kind of how-to of hazelnuts, we're really not going to get into the how to plant them. We're really going to discuss more availability of plants and some of the structures on how people can get into growing them. On the commercial scale right now, because we're limited in supply of plants, we're doing a very tightly controlled release, and we need to do it in an equitable way that's fair, but also strategic in order to actually develop the industry. So a lot of the discussion is going to be about that. It will open on Friday afternoon at 1 p.m. I am going to be hosting a field day at our research fields at Rosemount for an hour and a half. And so that will be more, well, it's a breeding field. So I won't get so much into how to grow them so much as how we breed them. But you can learn a little bit about how to grow them as well. Registration is still open. I'm not sure when we are going to reach our cap of registration. So if you want to register as soon as possible. And it's very easy to find the registration. Just Google Midwest Hazelnuts.
Midwest Hazelnuts. Well, I thank you so much, Lois Brown, for joining us. And thank Jenny Holtz with Green Earth Growers for joining us in the first segment. And so those two conferences, there's also a regenerative poetry conference nearby the two. And so there's some interactions there because having the chickens and hazelnuts. So let's do a glimmer economics. Let's have a glimmer future for all, and find a way of working with nature. Hazelnuts.